Today, my guest is Dr. Jade Teta, author, lecturer, and expert in female hormonal metabolism and psychology. Coming up, the truth about calories in versus calories out.
And we say, you know, eat less, exercise more, calories in, calories out. That probably is the most important thing to understand about the science of metabolism. However, while calories are important, you don't really need to count them. And if you take that to the extreme, you actually can have the opposite effect.
How running can actually make you fat.
It's a study on women. It lasted a year, and they took three different groups of women doing cardiovascular exercise and telling them, hey, what we want you to do is we want you to do running on a treadmill. And the three groups were the following. One group did 60 minutes on a treadmill 5 days per week. Another group did 45 minutes of treadmill running 5 days per week. And the last group did 30 minutes. So about 75% of these women responded to calorie burning with increased appetite, wiping out any weight loss and or even causing some weight gain.
Psychedelics and how they can help with trauma.
Well, if we go back to the analogy of this knotted ball of yarn, right, and this deep story that's underneath, what psychedelics do is they start to unravel that ball of yarn a little bit.
Dr. Jade, I am truly honored to have you as a guest on my show, having followed your work in mind, muscle, female metabolism, and now spirituality. I feel greatly honored to have you on my show. Welcome.
Thank you, Sonia. It's an honor to be here. Excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, I can't wait. And you've got your own podcast, Next Level Human. And one of the things I love about your introduction into that is you talk about the four jobs that we have, earning money, health and fitness, personal relationships, and meaning. And I'd love to explore all of those areas. But before we do, Dr. Jade, I always ask my guests to give me and my audience a little bit of background on your journey and how you got to this point.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yes, it's been an interesting journey. I started out, actually, a lot of people don't realize this, but I started out at 15 years old as a personal trainer. And so people go, 15, that's kind of crazy, right? But that's the reason I say 15 is because that's the first time I ever collected money for writing a program or building some kind of fitness program for people. And so if you take a personal trainer, and I've been doing that, actually, I still do that. Actually, a lot of my money, most of my money still currently comes from workouts, believe it or not. So if you take a personal trainer and you throw that into a blender with a natural medicine physician, I ended up going to a unique school in the United States that trains primary care doctors in alternative and complementary medicine, so functional medicine. So if you came to see me as a physician, rather than drugs and surgery, which I'm not against, I would start with lifestyle, nutrition, supplementation. And what's funny about that is when I did that, I graduated from medical school back in 2004. That was at a time where functional medicine and alternative medicine was considered, you know, sort of very fringe and witch doctor type of medicine. And I had no idea. I had no idea it was going to become mainstream at the time. So take that personal trainer, combine that with a natural medicine physician, and then put in a hefty dose of psychology and philosophy. And you sort of have an idea of what I do. I will say this, that is kind of surprising for a lot of people. Most of my specialty in medicine has been around hormones, and specifically in women, which is always surprising for individuals. They're kind of like, how did you get into female endocrinology or female hormones? And the fact is, since I started this work way back in my teens, it was always working with women between the ages of 35 and 65. So you kind of have to become an expert in female metabolism and hormones if you really want to get results. And so that's part of what I've done mostly. And then recently, as you alluded to, the Next Level Human work is just essentially me moving in a direction of more psychology and philosophy, because what I have seen after, you know, whatever it is, 30 plus years doing natural medicine and you know, functional medicine and personal training is that the body follows where the mind goes. We tell ourselves stories all of the time about life. And if we don't have those stories correct, we can't actually achieve a new identity. And this is one of the reasons why people fail repeatedly in trying to change their lifestyle in any way. And so for me, I've taken a pretty hard turn into psychology and philosophy in addition to my metabolism work, because I think it really does start there. And then I'll say one more thing that that might be surprising, that this then takes me into my next level human work. I'm now working on my PhD in psychology, just beginning that process.
Wow.
And one of the things that I think is important is that we don't always tie things like romantic heartbreak and mother and father wounds and difficulty at work and purpose and meaning directly to our health and fitness pursuits, but they are 100% related, and they determine whether or not we're going to be successful with body change in health and fitness. And so that's one of the reasons I've heavily moved in that direction. So hopefully that gives everyone sort of an understanding of who I am. The best way to think about it and sum it up is mindset, muscle, and metabolism. I work in those three domains, and that's a lot of what I do.
Wow, my gosh, there is so much to unpack there. and so much that I'm like, oh my gosh, I completely sort of resonate. And I'm dying to understand the philosophy, like you say, and the psychology that goes behind having myself chased my own body image all my life, and sort of then taking that back to my parents, also having a great interest in personal growth, and what happened, you know, as growing young and sort of areas around that, and why I was sort of fixated on body composition, etc. But let's sort of break various different areas down. Firstly, you said that you sort of focused in on metabolism, particularly female metabolism. There is a great, and you know, the one thing that we're all told is, well, there's a lot of people that say out there, you know, it's all about calories in, calories out, and it's quite a simple equation. And why isn't it that more people can't just live this lifestyle and actually not put on weight and just follow this simple rule of calories in and calories out? Is it really that simple?
Well, yes and no. And this is going to be where you'll constantly hear this answer. On the one hand, if logically, yes, if we just say, what is the science? And we say, you know, eat less, exercise more, calories in, calories out. That probably is the most important thing to understand about the science of metabolism. However, while calories are important, you don't really need to count them. And if you take that to the extreme, you actually can have the opposite effect. And I'll give you an example of this and just walk you through this. A lot of people think that the metabolism is just like a calculator, right? So you type in the number that of items that you're taking in calories, and you subtract out the number of calories you burn through exercise, and that's supposed to create a linear, predictable weight loss equation. And if the world was perfect, that would work just fine, except the metabolism doesn't work in a linear, predictable way. It adjusts, and it compensates, and it changes, and it adapts. And so while we think that eating less and exercising more is going to end up speeding up metabolism and helping us burn fat and all these kind of things, what actually happens is the body, the metabolism, is very smart. So it starts to budget, and it says, okay, we've just, you know, withdrawn $200 from our fat bank account, and we're exercising like crazy, and we're going to go broke if we don't do something about this. So we need to recapture that somewhere. And so then hunger goes up and cravings go up, and then metabolic rate declines, and you start seeing this compensation that occurs. And this is why we hit a plateau, and or we actually end up gaining weight. And I'll give you a funny little, you know, well, it's not funny, it's kind of tragic in a sense, but I'll refer to a study here, one of my favorite. It's a study on women. It lasted a year, and they took three different groups of women doing cardiovascular exercise and telling them, hey, what we want you to do is we want you to do running on a treadmill. The three groups were the following. One group did 60 minutes on a treadmill 5 days per week. Another group did 45 minutes of treadmill running 5 days per week. And the last group did 30 minutes of treadmill running 5 days a week. And they were told, don't change your diet. Don't change your diet at all. Just do this exercise. And they followed these women for a year. That is a very long time. And that is a lot of cardiovascular exercise. And just so people know, how many calories would you burn in an hour running on a treadmill or 30 minutes? It's probably going to be somewhere between 200 and 600 calories burned. So you would think all those calories burned without any change in diet, what's going to happen? Everyone should lose weight. Except what happened was only 25% of those women lost weight. Another 50% had no change in their weight at all. And 25% actually gained weight. And so the question then goes, well, why did this happen to these women? While they didn't make a conscious change in their diet, they actually ended up eating more as a result of the hunger and cravings that the metabolism put in place because they were doing this exercise. So about 75% of these women responded to calorie burning with increased appetite, wiping out any weight loss and or even causing some weight gain. And everyone who hears me, I guarantee, if you're listening to this right now, you're probably shaking your head and going, this has happened to me and or I've seen this happen to someone else. And this is how the metabolism really works. So it's not actually a calculator. And I'll let you just have a comment because I can tell you want to jump in here. And then I'll tell you a little bit about how it does work.
I spent the first, I guess, as I said, I've always been into health and fitness. And I spent, I guess, the first 20 years of my life doing cardio. And literally, certainly the latter 10 of that sort of part of my life, I was running, like you said, on a treadmill and my lunch break doing 10Ks every single day. I became addicted to running. And I'm more of a runner's build. And I guess I was what they call skinny fat. I didn't have, no one would definitely call me fat. I've never been sort of big. But I still didn't have the body of my dreams. On the weight side, it didn't really change massively. I probably, like you say, put on a little bit. And it wasn't, for me, it was only until I really turned to serious resistance training. And when I say serious resistance training, I was doing a little bit of weightlifting, but not seriously lifting. And it wasn't until I completely changed what I did. And now I see women that are still spending hours doing cardio, and I'm like looking, going, no, you want the beautiful, you want that wonderful figure, ditch the cardio and lift, start doing some heavy lifting. So no, I completely agree. The other thing I was going to say is I got accused a lot of the time as, oh, look, you're okay. You've obviously got a fast metabolism. And it was that sort of, is there such thing as a fast metabolism? Because I didn't actually think I did have a fast metabolism, whatever that means.
Yeah. Interestingly enough that we humans, right, of the primates, if you look at, sort of data on all the apes, in a sense, we have the fastest metabolisms of all the great apes, which we are descended from, in a sense. And yet we end up having the highest body fat. And so ultimately, what that tells us, and there's a lot of this is research by Herman Ponser out of Duke University, who essentially is looking and saying what we thought about having a fast metabolism actually works in the other direction. Usually the faster the metabolism, the heavier the body. And you might say, well, how does that work? Well, just what I said, when you try to speed up metabolism, what else do? You speed up hunger, you speed up cravings. And so the faster the metabolism, the more we typically want to eat. And so we don't really want a fast metabolism. What we want is a flexible metabolism. And what that means is a metabolism that when you encounter stress, you don't end up overeating. It can handle missing a meal. It can handle a very intense workout program. It can handle when you're only eating carbs. It can handle when you're only eating fat. It can handle all different situations without adjusting and adapting with hunger and cravings. So we don't necessarily want a fast metabolism. What's more important is that we have a flexible metabolism. And flexible to what? Flexible to stress. So if you really want to know, if it's not about calories, calories are certainly important, and the science says that, but that's not where you're going to make your get your results by hyper-focusing on calories. What you probably want to focus on is hyper-focusing on stress. Now, as soon as I say that word, it opens up a can of worms because stress is completely overused. It's misunderstood from a metabolism perspective, and it's probably better thought of as metabolic tension in a sense. And I'll explain how this works, because what the metabolism really is, it's not a calculator. It's also not a hormonal chemistry set, like some people say. What it really is it is more like a stress barometer. Here's an example of how to think about metabolism. Imagine a satellite, right? And this satellite has one dish, one satellite dish focusing outside, looking at the environment. So for someone like Sonia, it's saying, okay, what's Sonia's weather like in London where she is right now? How bright is it? What season is it, right? How much food availability does she have? How much stress is she under at work? It's looking out and looking at you and your environment, and it's measuring how much stress is out there. What's going on with your sleep? How hard are you exercising? What kind of fuel can you take in? All of this stuff. However, it has another satellite dish as well that focuses inside. So it looks inside the body and goes, okay, what are the liver's needs? And what is the fat cells' needs? And what do the muscles need? And what does the brain need? And it then integrates all that outside information with all that inside data, and it plots a course back to balance. So now imagine if this is a satellite that is measuring stress in the outside world and trying to match that with what the internal environment needs, then it's always going to be looking at one thing in particular above all else. It's going to be looking at how much calories are you bringing in versus how many calories are being burned. And that gap between calories in and calories out, we tend to want to see that as a calculator equation, but instead we should be seeing it as a stress equation. In other words, the bigger that gap gets, the more stress is on the metabolic system, and the more it's probably going to react with hunger and cravings. And think about it this way for people who are confused by this. Think about a dieter who eats less and exercises more, and think about how he or she, how their hunger and cravings typically will be. They'll typically have excess hunger. They'll typically have cravings. They'll typically have unpredictable, unstable energy. That's the plight of a chronic dieter. However, the couch potato, what we call it here in the United States, is the person who lays on the couch all day and just eats all day. That person also has a huge calorie gap, except now they're taking in way too much food and not burning it. So the calorie gap is really big. To the metabolism, both the dieter and the couch potato, that calorie gap in both ways, even though they're opposite, is a stress to the system. And both of them will have increased hunger, increased cravings, and unpredictable, unstable energy. Why? Because the metabolism's major stress throughout its evolution was what? Starvation. And so it will prepare for starvation when you're overeating and not moving, and it will prepare for starvation when you're overmoving and also undereating. And so that's that gap in calories sends a message. In the case of the couch potato, it says, hey, winter's coming. In the case of the dieter, it says, winter's here. Both of those are stressful for the metabolism. And that's one way to think about this. It's an adaptable, adjustable, reactive system. What is it adjusting and reacting to? Stress. What's the major stress? The gap between calorie intake and calorie output. And so I'll say one final thing here, I'll say, how do you fix that? Well, you fix that by, instead of eating less and exercising more, or eating more and exercising less, you begin to match the calories and bring them back to balance. For example, let's take an athlete, right? No athlete in their right mind is going to eat less and exercise more. They don't do that. Not if they want to be good at their sport. What they do is they eat more to fuel the exercise. So they eat more and they exercise more, and they end up having the best bodies. We all want to look like athletes, but we don't do what an athlete would do. Likewise, let's take the Parisian, the stereotypical Parisian woman walking up four flights of steps every day. She is not exercising and running like crazy and doing CrossFit and all this stuff. She's walking all the time and she's eating very sparingly. That's an eat less, exercise less approach. Both of those approaches narrow the calorie gap, take stress off the system, and are easier lifestyles for us to maintain, if that makes sense.
That is just huge, actually, in terms of the penny dropping, having spent, as I say, spent the majority of my life trying to figure out how to lose weight, even though I wasn't really overweight, just becoming obsessed with. I was in exactly that sort of chain, as a lot of, I think a lot of women are, that just eat less or go on some crazy diet and exercise all the time, go to this class, that class, this cardio, that cardio, and literally eat like a pigeon and hope you lose weight. And really realize that you're just fatigued, but you're sort of getting energy by thinking, oh, but I've just got to get through the next training session and I'll just eat something quickly now, and you'll never relax. So that it actually completely makes sense to me now. And I think, why don't more people know that? And as you say, it's that balance, that sweet spot. So I guess the next question would be is, how do you reach that sweet spot? And I guess it's different for everybody. And
Yes.
is it the same for men? And is it the same for women? Having again gone through this whole 20 years of my life being told, train like a man, there isn't any difference. Of course, we can train like men. And I was a very much an alpha woman in the city, doing the whole woman in a man's world. And yeah, I can train like a man. Of course, I can. And now I completely realize I can't, couldn't. And it was a complete ego thing.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting, right? Because we're also in an interesting cultural time, aren't we? Where we're starting to kind of see, and by the way, the science sort of addresses this. There are real differences, biologically speaking, between male and female. And now we're talking about sex, not gender, right? We're talking about, male genitalia, female genitalia. That's sexual dimorphism. There are real differences biologically. We know that. Women menstruate, men do not. Women have two major sex steroids, men have one. Women go through five stages of hormonal life stages, men go through two at best, right? And so there are real differences here. Women's hormones fluctuate throughout the month, men don't. Now, at the same time, what we also know, and I just want to address this, we also know that just like on average, men are taller than women. You will certainly find certain women who are taller than most men, right? So we kind of look at this idea that we can look at generalities. And what we do see with gender now is that there is more nuance than just straight male, female. But with all that said, and acknowledging that, what we need to understand is that, yes, men and women are different biologically. For most people, that's a no duh moment. It's like, yeah, duh. Just think about menses versus men don't menstruate, right? At the same time, then we have to acknowledge that more mature women are different than younger women. As women approach perimenopause, menopause, postmenopause, pregnancy changes, that a pregnant woman is a woman who's going to be very different than a non-pregnant woman. There's just these gradations. And then more importantly, every woman and every man is different than every other woman and every man. And so your question was, how do we account for this individuality? Well, we have to learn how the metabolism speaks, and it doesn't speak, English or Spanish or French. It speaks metabolism. And that language is a language of biofeedback. So things like the way you're sleeping, whether your sleep is good quantity and good quality and not fragmented, things like mood. Can you remain focused? Are you stuck in anxiety and depression or resistance or frustration and these kinds of things? What's going on with hunger, energy, and cravings? We talked about that, right? We talked about this idea of, you can have excess hunger, unpredictable energy, unrelenting cravings. But these things like sleep, hunger, mood, energy, and cravings, this is a funny little acronym I'm known for called SHMEC that everyone laughs about. But the idea of SHMEC being in check versus out of check. If sleep, hunger, mood, energy, and cravings is in check, this probably means your metabolism is not under stress, that your metabolism is handling things just fine. If SHMEC is out of check, in other words, sleep is difficult and fragmented, mood is changing and volatile, energy is unpredictable and unstable, hunger is constant and unrelenting, cravings for all these kinds of foods, that tells you that your metabolism is perhaps under stress. And so the first thing to understand is, how do we understand what works for us? We first have to understand how to read the metabolism. If SHMEC's in check, you're probably just fine. and you are going to be able to push hard on the metabolism, diet, exercise, etc. If Schmeck goes out of check, that means things aren't fine. And think about this from a female perspective, which I've worked with my whole life. Think about how a woman might feel during the first half of her menstrual cycle, right, where she's a week prior to ovulation versus a week prior to menses. She's going to have a whole different sort of subset of sleep, hunger, mood, energy, and cravings. And then once you understand that, you can start to adjust your diet to stabilize sleep, hunger, mood, energy, and cravings first. That's the first thing you do. Get sleep, hunger, mood, energy, and cravings under control. Once it is under control, now your metabolism is in a place of strength. Now you can push on it a little bit. And when you do begin to push on it, you'll see how far it can go. And it's sort of this back and forth playing metabolic detective. You know, so Sonia has to be a metabolic detective. Jade has to be a metabolic detective. All the people listening to this conversation right now, we need to stop being dieters, start being metabolic detectives. How do we do that? We learn to read the signals that our body is sending, and then we learn to adjust and find the right mix of macronutrients and micronutrients, as well as exercise, that keep us in that stable place.
So I guess a lot of people look at almost what they're ingesting in terms of food and, you know, okay, is this making me feel good? Am I, you know, am I allergic to this type of food? Does this make me put on weight? Do I bloat with this food? So I think there's a lot of work around that. But actually all the other things that you said, sleep, hunger, mood, I know out of those categories, the one thing that really affects me is sleep. All the other things I'm pretty really good with, but it's the sleep that's the biggest, I'd say is my biggest issue that I know, you know, when I'm actually it's just quite constant is the sleep thing. And that could be, well, I guess various different reasons why you know your sleep is affected. But do you, once you've worked out that one thing or that two things, or maybe it's all of those things, is that when you can then start working on your diet and exercise program?
Yes, that's exactly right. In other words, like what I oftentimes say, and the listeners can remember this whenever you get an argument or a debate about diet, some people say it's just about calories, and you should ask them, how many calories does sleep have? How many calories does stress have? And what you're alluding to here is that stress and sleep, while you can't eat them, they do have a lot of calories. Because if you get sleep deprived or you're under a lot of stress, you're likely to overeat. And so exactly what you said, the first thing is get your biofeedback stable. We all know what it's like trying to eat healthily or be on a diet when we're hungry and craving all the time. When we're in that case, we're fighting ourselves constantly. So step one is get sleep, hunger, mood, energy, and cravings. And by the way, Sonia, it's not just sleep, hunger, mood, energy, and cravings. Schmeck is a catch-all phrase for exercise performance, exercise recovery, signs and symptoms like digestive health, headaches. When it comes to women, libido, right? Menses are two factors that you want to look at. For men, it's libido and erections, right? So all of these things, all the signs and symptoms, all the things that your body is telling you, you want to take into account. All of that is Schmeck. And so what the first job is to get Schmeck in check, right? Once you do that, then you start going the following. And here's the way that I would do this to make it very simple. Let's say Sonia and I wake up and we have breakfast, right? And let's say you and I, we have, let's say, bacon and eggs, okay? Or bangers and eggs, right? If we're in London, right? So what's going to happen now is we want to look for the next 4 to 6 hours, a good, healthy, flexible metabolism. You and I should be able to go for 4 to 6 hours without hunger, without cravings, and with stable energy. And at the end of that 4 to 6 hours, we should be ready to eat better foods, right? And healthier foods and less of those foods. In other words, we should be like, hey, what do you want to get for lunch? And you're like, well, let's get a salad with maybe chicken breasts on it. And we should both be like, oh, that sounds great, and be satisfied with that, versus let's go get burgers or pizza or, you know, Indian food or Thai and just pig out. Because what we do for breakfast, what we eat or don't eat, should positively impact what we choose to eat, how much we eat, what we crave to eat at lunch and dinner. So what most people do is they just think about this meal as if it's independent from every other meal. And that's not the case. What you eat or don't eat for breakfast will impact what you eat or don't eat for lunch, will impact what you eat or don't eat for dinner. How you sleep, good or bad, will impact whether you're going to want to overeat junk food at breakfast. And so what we want to do is we want to just go back and say, why did I make the choices that I made around dinner? Here in the United States, we have what we call continuous meal. People wake up, they either don't have breakfast or they ate a small little breakfast. Then they're, you know, this is the typical dieter. Then they go to lunch and they get a tiny little salad. And then they get to dinner. And when they get home from work, they're so hungry, they end up eating from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m., which I call continuous meal, all their calories. And then I say, well, it's because of what you did at breakfast and lunch that led to this overeating at dinner. And so that's what I mean with looking at and becoming the metabolic detective. And there's one aspect of SHMEC, which is HEC, H-E-C, that aspect, hunger, energy, cravings, that you can measure from meal to meal. So, okay, Sonny and I had breakfast of eggs and bacon. What was our HEC, hunger, energy, and cravings for the next 4 to 6 hours? It should be stable and under control. It should help us eat better and less foods later. This is what we're missing, because we don't realize that meals are not mutually exclusive. They are directly related to one another. Same thing goes for stress. Same thing goes for sleep. Same thing goes for exercise. Is that making sense, and clarify that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the question I would have then is, in terms of getting down to the detail, I'm intermittent. I intermittent fast at the moment, but I've gone from having an absolutely dreadful diet for most of my career, having been in the city, which most of it I was drinking my calories, and having some very much under eating and then overtraining. I competed a couple of times, so I went into a bodybuilder, eating six times a day, which. That's actually when I really started understanding nutrition, because for the first time I was actually eating and not putting weight on. Well, not putting it on in a bad way. My body was changing body composition, and I loved it. And now I'm very much into the longevity and reading how actually intermittent fasting is the best to sort of, to maintain a healthy, longer life without the sort of the aging effects. What are your views around, is it sort of the small meals often, little and often, or should we intermittent fast?
Yeah, it's both. And I'll show you, and I know that always confuses people, but here's the way to think about this. So ideally, let's say that our metabolism doesn't know, right? It doesn't know that there's a Starbucks on every corner, that there's a fast food joint on every corner, that we can get food whenever we need. It doesn't know that. So ideally, right, if you and I just got dropped off on some deserted island somewhere and we were forced to intermittent fast, we would get fantastic results, because we wouldn't be able to compensate even if we wanted to. We would just have to deal with the hunger and cravings, because we're not going to be able to go binge on pizza, right? So it's true that intermittent fasting in terms of the mechanism is perfect in a perfect world, but we don't live in a perfect world. And so for many of us, and I'm a little bit like you, I can easily go, all day, not eat, and eat pretty decently. It's just a kind of choice, a switch in my head, eat pretty decently for dinner. So intermittent fasting works for me, but intermittent fasting can become intermittent fattening for other people. And let me explain how that works. Just like I said, so how do you know if it's intermittent fattening for you? Well, you skip breakfast, let's say, and you get to lunch and you're so hungry that you end up overeating. And as a result of skipping breakfast, you also end up overeating at dinner as well. So the idea here is calories still matter. And what we're basically trying to do is that some people in the modern world can easily consume 3,000 to 5,000 calories in a sitting. Just go to a place like in the United States, like the Cheesecake Factory or something like that, where it's basically like you can eat a lot of food all at one sitting, and a lot of people do, right? So you have to ask yourself, if I fast, and this is playing metabolic detective again, you go like this. You go, okay, well, I'm sitting here listening to Jade and Sonia, and Sonia fasts, and Jade fasts too. And, I know that mechanism can work, but will it work for me? Well, then the idea is try it. and see what happens to hunger, energy, and cravings, and see if as a result of fasting, you end up eating more food and worse food later, or you end up eating less food and better food later, right? And so with someone like you, Sonia, it sounds like you, it's a wash, right? You either do better overall with fasting and or you don't overeat, right? So you just eat enough and it works for you. But for other people, it doesn't. And for people who have very inflexible metabolisms, and you put a certain percentage of those people just on an intermittent fasting program, and I can tell you this clinically, it happens all the time. I would say anywhere from, you know, I'll take a guess, 60% of those people, especially people who are overweight, who are struggling with an inflexible metabolism, 60% will respond poorly because their metabolism has never, it's too stressful. You can't go from a couch potato to a intermittent fasting paleo person overnight, right? It's kind of like taking an elite athlete and telling them, let's not go through the preseason. You know, let's just throw you right into the game. You're going to be asking for injuries. And the same thing happens with the metabolism. So in that case, many of these people do indeed need to do a small, frequent meals in the beginning to control hunger, energy, and cravings. And so people always ask, we tend to do this. We have very binary, dualistic ways of thinking, us humans. And so what we'll do is, which is better, fasting or eating small, frequent meals? And the answer is, it depends. And you might say, then the next question is, depends on what? And I'll say, it depends on how, which one stabilizes hunger, energy, and cravings. Which one causes you to eat less and better foods overall? For some people, fasting is going to cause you to eat less and healthier. For other people, it's going to cause you to eat worse and more. In that case, you want to do small, frequent meals. In the other case, you can continue doing fasting. And to me, the big pet peeve of mine is, I would really love when we humans finally understand that it is not a one-size-fits-all thing. And just because we read, you know, a bunch of research on how good intermittent fasting is, and it is, and it can do amazing things, does not mean it will work for every person. So for someone like Sonia, and think about this too, Sonia, right? Like you and me, we've been around the block a little bit. You talked about the idea that, you know, I've been through these different things, Jade. There was a time where I was, you know, eating like a pigeon and running for miles. There's another time where I was bodybuilding and learning this and that. And you're a student. So slowly but surely, you figured it out, right? You're an information seeker. You figured it out. You've played metabolic detective. So in your case, I would say, that's perfect, because I can tell that you've done the experimentation with you. And I also will make a bet about you as well. I bet you you're someone that if it stops working, you're going to be the kind of person that keeps seeking. You'll quickly figure it out and you'll go, that worked for a time. I know how it works and I'm going to figure out now the next thing. That's to me how this works. So hopefully that doesn't confuse people, because for some of you, small frequent meals are going to be the thing that's going to be what makes you get the results. For others, you can copy Sonia and you're going to get great results from that, but you have to honor your own metabolism. There's only one rule in all of metabolism in my mind, and that is do what works for you, which means you have to find it, which means you have to stop being the dieter and start being the detective, which I would say Sonia is.
You know, as you mentioned before, women have, what, 5 stages, really, in their life. Now, I'm sort of going through menopause, just gone through menopause, not quite exactly sure. But I've really had to look at what I used to be able to do when I was younger and what I can do now. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit around the various different stages of women's hormones and how how we should adapt our diet and exercise around
that? Yeah, 100%. And the way to understand this is, so let's go through what I talked about before. So younger women who are menstruating, they go through basically 4 different stages every month, hormonal stages. The first hormonal stage during menses. So, and you'll have to forgive me because, of course, I've never been through menses, but this is my work. And so,
for everyone, so that's like your period here in England.
Yes, exactly.
It's a very scientific word.
But yeah. So, basically, the first day of bleeding for your period, we consider day 1 of the menstrual cycle. Now, during that first 14 days, what's happening is estrogen levels are rising. The follicle, which holds the egg, is secreting estrogen. Now, estrogen and progesterone are what I like to call non-identical twin sisters. They have some overlapping personality. That's why they're twins, but not exactly the same mechanisms. That's why they're non-identical. So estrogen is the athlete. She's the entrepreneur. She's the type A. She's the go-getter. She's like, let's attack life. And when estrogen is around, women are able to, they are more insulin sensitive. They're able to tolerate more carbohydrate intake. They can eat more without gaining weight. They can eat less without losing muscle, right? Estrogen is a really beautiful hormone because it acts like testosterone in its ability to gain muscle. It also is fat burning in its effect because of its impact on insulin. And it also blocks cortisol. And so during this first 14 days, estrogen wakes up early and is playing, and progesterone is still sleeping in bed, right? So estrogen is dominating, and women tend to feel really good, really focused, really on their game, and their body tends to respond better when estrogen is dominating. Now, at ovulation, the follicle releases the egg, and the follicle becomes the corpus luteum. Now, the corpus luteum becomes the source of progesterone. Progesterone is the opposite in terms of she's the artist, right? So she's the artist, she's the person, she's the yogi, she's the one that wants to go to yoga and, you know, do pottery and is very calm. And she's really trying to look after estrogen and keep estrogen out of trouble. She's motherly. She is a worrier. She's like, don't engage too much over here because you may get in trouble. And so progesterone works with estrogen to block stress, but it works against estrogen with insulin. It makes you more insulin resistant, which, by the way, makes sense because the female metabolism is incredibly smart, right? So it goes, well, you might have a baby coming along. And if that baby's coming along, we need extra blood sugar and extra blood fats to feed that baby. So progesterone worries. She's a future thinker. So she goes, we might have a baby coming along. Let's save some resources just in case. Now, also, progesterone is very anxiolytic. It's anxiety reducing. So what ends up happening then is each month in a younger woman, you get this estrogen dominant phase, and then you get this progesterone dominant phase. And what happens there is that when estrogen is playing by itself, you can really work out harder, eat more, whatever you want. Anything you do is going to be a little bit easier. Once progesterone comes in, and especially as you start to approach your period and get into premenstrual syndrome and things like that, estrogen and progesterone drop away. And now the female metabolism is looking a little bit more like a male metabolism. And so if you understand that, and I'll give you another analogy just to remember this, another very simple way is Joan of Arc. You know Joan of Arc? So Joan of Arc had her shield, she had her suit of armor, and she had her sword. So the suit of armor is most protective, right? Think about that as estrogen. Estrogen is most protective against food and against stress. The shield is progesterone. So it's also protective, just not as protective. And the sword is obviously testosterone. Now, at perimenopause, as you approach menopause, what ends up happening is the shield gets knocked out of Joan of Arc's hand. She loses her shield. She loses progesterone. That means she's going to be more worried, more anxiety, perhaps sleep fragmentation, and a little bit more stress reactive. So during this perimenopausal phase, it's a good idea that if progesterone is gone, someone has to mother estrogen. So the woman has to become a little bit more motherly to herself, more time at spas, getting facials, manicures, pedicures, massages. Sex and physical affection. Orgasm is an amazing way to reduce stress. Walking, especially in green settings, any creative pursuits, meditation, all of these things that calm the body down are the first step to reduce stress because you've lost your shield, right?
And I get that, having been through it, but I didn't realize what was happening. Because quite often women were not told these things. I mean, I had no idea about menopause. No one talks to it. You know, we're told about the other way around, going through puberty and when our periods are going to start, but we're not told about what's going to happen later in life.
Yes.
So a lot of women, and I know I did, and funnily enough, I went through it sort of through COVID. So I was having a few of these symptoms and I just presumed it was, oh, you know, we're not living in great times, so I'm feeling a bit down, I'm not sleeping at night, and I just put it down to these strange times. And then I started researching, and because I experiment on myself, I'm all into my research and looking things up. So it's just interesting that you say look after yourself, and I think knowing that is part of the issue. If we know that this is what we're going through, and that can start as early as your late 30s for perimenopause, and so in some women, or yes, during your 40s, and it can, mm-hmm, can really vary,
and it can last up to 10 years, right? Yes. And so a lot of women are in this stage for a very long time, but it's pretty easy to deal with so long as you start realizing that I can't put my body in under any extra stress. And remember, diet and exercise can be a stress. This is why women go, what I was doing prior to perimenopause, which was working great, is no longer working because it's become too stressful, right? And that's when you really got to start minding the calorie gap. Now at menopause, now Joan of Arc gets stripped of her armor as well. Now estrogen is gone as well. This means not only is she even more reactive to stress, so you got to double down on stress reduction again, but she's also now more reactive to calories, and especially carbohydrate calories. And so at this point, because of what it does to insulin, so at this point, you begin to also reduce carbohydrates. So now it's reduced stress in perimenopause. Then at menopause, it's reduce stress and reduce, you know, sort of carbohydrates. And one of the things that happens after menopause, postmenopause, is now she's, testosterone has fallen too. So she's got a broken shield, a sword, but she's still got a sword. And she's a little bit more testosterone dominant, a lot of women at this stage. And this is where
mine plummeted, and because, yes, I lift weights, that was, I realized I was losing my strength in the gym.
Yes.
And that's when I went to my doctor and I went, hang on, I need this HRT, whatever it is. And I'd done my research and I said,
yeah,
I want you to test me to testosterone. And in England, and I don't know if it's the same in the US, they're very reluctant to give women testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first thing they say is, oh, you're going to get hairy, or, mm-hmm, oh, your voice will drop, and all of this. And I was like, do you know what? I don't think I will. Can I just, mm-hmm, I'll take a risk. Please, yeah, test me, because I know I go and I lift weights and I can't lift what I used to.
Yep.
And sure enough, mine had dropped off. My libido also had literally, mm-hmm, dropped off a cliff.
Yeah.
And yeah, then basically I got the testosterone, and it's really a tiny amount. It's, yep, it's not the same as a guy having testosterone replacement. Yeah. Completely different. It changed my life. Absolutely.
Yeah, it will. And you know what's amazing, interesting? You get two for one with testosterone as a woman as well, because testosterone through aromatase turns into estrogen. So one of the benefits of taking testosterone if you're low is you're also getting you're getting a good kick of estrogen. And just for the women listening, one of the things that Asani alluded to, libido is the kickoff here with women. With men, it's not necessarily the case, but testosterone and estrogen together are really play a huge role in female libido. So if you notice that your libido has taken a dive, one of the things you want to do is definitely look at testosterone therapy. And yes, HRT, we do it a lot here in the United States. I know, being familiar with London and having spent some time there, and I understand the UK system, they don't necessarily do a whole lot. It's getting better. But yes, here in the United States, we definitely work with testosterone in women a lot. And there's a difference, remember, between I know you know this, Sonia, but let's just share it with the listener. Yeah. There's a difference between a testosterone replacement therapy and taking steroids, right? Like, testosterone replacement therapy is just going, okay, Sonia, we see that your testosterone is a little low. Let's give you enough to replace it back to normal. It's not super physiological levels. That's when you start running into problems if you're taking super physiological levels. But if you're restoring back to normal values, and remember, these hormones are bioidentical, so it looks exactly like the testosterone that your ovaries would have been producing to begin with. And the body just goes, oh, perfect. I've got testosterone. I can help. I can make my bones stronger. I can increase my muscle mass. I can have a healthy libido. I can have all these things. And it's very healthy in that regard. And I'll give women just a general rule of HRT. In the beginning with perimenopause, almost always restoring with progesterone can be very valuable, or using a progesterone like herb that like Vitex or also known as chasteberry. So typically in perimenopause, we'll use something like chasteberry or Vitex to help the brain hear progesterone signal better. I call this a female specific adaptogen, and or we'll give oral micronized progesterone, something like Prometrium or something like that. And that works really well in perimenopause with a lot of these symptoms. Once you get into menopause, which typically for in medicine, menopause is just a moment in time, basically. It's a time when you have been a year without your period. However, hormonally speaking, I talk about menopause as a particular hormone profile, which is low estrogen and progesterone. Now, you certainly could add estrogen in as well at this time to the progesterone if you wanted to. And this is where you start getting into things like vaginal dryness, you start getting into hot flashes. Estrogen does have a libido, impact. So you can certainly use estrogen there as well. But one of the things that your doctor did with you and you being very savvy in researching is you just basically said, okay, my T is low and I want to add that in, and you're getting estrogen as well. So you're getting a 2-for-1 with testosterone. That makes sense.
And I also took that. I'm also doing transdermal estrogen the progesterone as well.
So that's the ideal way to do it, right? Oral progesterone, a transdermal estrogen. You don't want to take estrogen orally because it can cause clots and things. And then testosterone, normally as pellet, patch, or sometimes injections.
This is just like a gel. A little bit of gel, and that's it.
And one of the things I'll say about that too, just so everyone knows, sometimes the gels work wonderfully, sometimes they don't. And so sometimes we need to adjust. So just remember, in Sonia's case, she got great results across the board. So that was the perfect prescription for you, it sounds like. For other women listening to this, you may need to adjust the delivery system because not everyone absorbs these creams the same way. Some people perspire a little bit more. All those things matter. But it can be highly beneficial, especially when you understand the personality profiles of the two sisters, estrogen and progesterone, and the brother, testosterone. Testosterone, by the way, the brother is really a stress hormone in women more so than it is in men. We actually know that women who are high stress, reactive, cortisol reactive, they actually end up with a really interesting hormone profile that is high cortisol with high, this is younger women, high cortisol with high testosterone and lower progesterone and more a little bit more estrogen dominant. And we also see that this high cortisol with high testosterone and lower relative estrogen and progesterone results in belly fat in women, even when they're thin women. And a lot of people get confused by that because they go, well, what do you mean a thin woman with belly fat? It just means a woman who is smaller, who tends to put most of her fat around her midsection. This has a very particular hormone profile. And in women, testosterone is driving some of that. What's interesting is estrogen is what gives women that gorgeous hourglass shape. Testosterone is not nearly as powerful to reduce belly fat. And so if you start gaining belly fat around menopause, you start to realize that's an estrogen effect. And this is how you begin to change these things.
And that is another thing I noticed. And I, again, because it was through lockdown and COVID, I just presumed it was, well, I'm not going to the gyms because the gyms were closed. I was lifting at home, but I wasn't lifting as heavy because I didn't have the equipment and I was training outside. But I just put that, my body composition completely changed. And ever since the HRT, I've changed my figure again. And it's quite miraculous seeing the changes. And obviously, no, I know now it's the HRT that's literally redistributing the fat to the places it should be rather than the places it shouldn't.
Yeah. And I'll tell you some interesting research on that. A lot of women will ask me, if I go on HRT, will I lose weight? And truth is, if you go on HRT and don't change your diet or aren't well schooled in diet like you, the typical response is no change in weight and or perhaps weight gain. But what it does do, even if women don't diet or don't know what to do with nutrition like you, is that it does cause a redistribution of fat. So while you may gain a little weight or not lose weight, you will lose some belly fat. And that is highly beneficial. Now, in your case, when you take someone who knows how to diet and is exercising and doing all the right things lifestyle wise, and then you take HRT, you can get a fantastic response. And it sounds like your testimonial speaks to that. And I see that in my clinic all the time. But just understand for women listening to this, if you don't change your lifestyle, HRT alone is not going to restore your figure. It's got to be that plus, attending to diet and exercise that is unique to you.
Just finally, because I do want to come on to the spirituality side of things. Mm-hmm. If you were to say to women, well, obviously you have a lot of female clients, mm-hmm. what would sort of be your, say, top three hacks if a woman was coming to you and saying, look, I need to lose weight and I'm in these areas, I'm not doing great in these areas and I want a diet or an exercise program?
Yeah. So first thing is to realize stress management is going to be key, because that's going to what's going to get Schmeck in check. So the first thing is that an hour extra in bed may be better than an hour extra on the treadmill. And women need to understand that. So more stress reducing time. But then the next would say, and this is just across the board, cut out junk food. We all basically know what junk food is, but I'll define it for you a little bit better. It's foods that are high in calories and high in the mixtures of fat, sugar, salt, starch, and alcohol. You know, these are the foods that you want. This is burgers and pizzas and, you know, noodles and, you know, anything that's got, you know, bread and cheese and fat and sugar and all of that kind of stuff. So most of us know what that is. And then begin to walk. Think of yourself as an old school Parisian, not the new Parisians, but the old school, where you basically walk, 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 and you eat sparingly, right? That's the first step. So stress management, number one. Number two, begin a walking routine. Number three, cut out junk food. And then the final thing I would say is, if you really want to take it to the next level and start getting the results that someone like Sonia gets, you have to begin to weight train. And this is something that most women simply are not aware of. And it's funny because it's seen as a young man's, you know, thing. But actually, the people who are going to benefit the most from resistance training are going to be more mature women. And so those would be the four things to begin to do. And notice how I'm not saying, you know, I'm trying to stay as simple as possible, right? Reduce stress, cut out junk food, become a walker rather than a sitter, and do some resistance training. And stick to those things exactly like that. Become, you know, militant about that, and then watch what happens to your physique. And then you can begin to do some other things. Then once you start getting results, you can take it to the next level when your metabolism is a little bit more flexible, and you can go, you know what, I'm going to start intermittent fasting with Sonia because I want to experience that, or I want to do something else. But those are the four places to start. And for the vast majority of women, that is literally all they need. They will get results if they do that. Reduce stress, cut out junk food, start walking, start resistance training. You might say, well, Jade, how much resistance training? Not much. 1 to 3 full body sessions per week is all most people are going to need. Unless you just love it and you're really good at it and you're like Sonia and you're just like, hey, I got to do this for my mental health and I love the way I feel and I love the way I look. Cool, but you don't have to overdo this. The big problem is people are overdoing the things and they don't need to do that. Harder is not better. Smarter is better. Harder is not better. Better is better. So you have to get to this place where you do enough, but not too much. The whole metabolism works off the Goldilocks principle. Don't go to extremes.
I love that. And Dr. Jade, it's absolutely true. If I look at how I've changed my diet, exercise, and just managing my life, it's changed over the last 10 years. And I can honestly say I've seen the best results having done all of those things that you've just said. So, so yes, great advice, great advice. Now, I want to change the topic a little bit, although I'm not sure how much it is really changing the topic, because I think there is one thing that links all of this, but you put a lot of personal growth into your, certainly into your work and your podcast. And you told me you were starting your PhD. What sort of got you into the personal growth area, and what sort of started that journey for you?
Yeah. Well, you know what I notice is that when people come, and I'm sure you see it all the time, right, Sonia? They come and they say, I want to do this thing, and I want to look this way, or I want to restore my health. It shows up in four areas, really, right? I want to work on my finances. I want to work on my health and fitness. I want to work on my personal relationships, specifically romance, right? Because we humans love romance. And I want to feel like my life matters and I'm making a difference. So these are the sort of four jobs that every human has to do. Now, here's what happens. What I realized is that when I'm talking to somebody, and what I'm most interested in, like if I was going to get to know you, I would be like, I really want to know what Sonia's identity is. Like what is, and what is identity all about? Identity is the stories that are in the back of your brain that drive everything you do. So what I realized early on is I was like, what people think is they think it's a habit problem. But then I was like, well, what drives habits? Your identity drives your habits. Your habits don't drive your identity. Who you think you are and the stories you're telling about your life. And so when you want to make a change, and I'll use harsh language here, I'm doing it on purpose simply because I want people to really get this. You literally have to murder your old identity. If you want to change, you can't be the same person. You have to change your identity. And people don't really know how to do this. They basically want to continue with their old identity and just make a couple habit changes. But those habit changes will never last because they're still stuck in their old identity. And so I got into this work because I was like, if people are really going to change and make these changes for good, they have to change their identity. And let's use you as an example, right? It sounds like one of your identity used to be a runner, right? You identified with that very strongly. Now you identify with something else. So now you're a bodybuilder. And now once you identify as a bodybuilder, you start doing bodybuilder things. Bodybuilders eat a particular way. Bodybuilders train a certain way. Bodybuilders go to certain types of gyms. Bodybuilders eat out a particular way. Bodybuilders prep their food a particular way, right? So everything about you now that you've identified with that is in alignment. And that's ultimately what the problem is. So if I can tell you all day long to do those four things, reduce stress, right? Cut out junk food, go for walks, do some resistance training. But if your identity is still someone who's a foodie and loves to overeat and is a, you know, loves wine, then immediately the new identity that I told you to follow is in conflict with your old identity. And you're not going to do any of what I told you, even though logically you might say, I'm going to try that. You won't do any of it because you haven't given up your identity of the foodie and the wine drinker. And so ultimately, it does come down to the identities that we have. And by the way, those identities are very, very much attached to our original development. You know, whether we have a mother wound or whether we have a father wound or, you know, whether we had safety and acceptance when we were young, whether we were we felt like we were in our adolescence, whether we felt like we were belong and were part of a group, whether we've been betrayed, whether we've had eating issues, regardless of what it is, our stories and our identity are attached to a past self. And what we need to realize is that we need to stop relating to that past self and start relating to a future self. And that future self has a different identity. Now, we all need to ask ourselves, when's the last time we completely changed our identity? And if we're going to change our body, and if we're going to get healthier, and if we're going to find romance, and if we're going to, you know, be well, you know, get our finances in order and all those things, we need a different identity. That's why this is crucial. And one of the things I'll say here, and I'll just start us off to see what you say. Mm-hmm. There's a difference in my mind in the idea of how most people approach this. In the United States, I'm not sure if you guys have the same saying in the UK, but there's a saying, fake it until you make it. Right? It's very popular here. Well, faking, basically what it says is I have an identity that's really me, and I'm going to pretend that I have this other identity. If we think about actors, it's like an actor. When the director says action, the actor puts on a different identity. And then when the director says cut, the actor goes back to their old identity. This is what most people are doing. They're playing the part. When they're in their gym, they're kind of dipping their toes in. But a method actor doesn't fake it until they make it. A method actor bees it until they see it. In other words, as soon as they know they got the role, they go, I'm this now and I'm this forever. And it's, you know, and it doesn't matter when the director says action, they're already playing the part. When the director says cut, they continue playing the part. Doesn't matter who's watching, they just are the thing. And so what people need to understand is it's be it until you see it. It's waking up and going, What would a bodybuilder do? What does a bodybuilder do? How do they live from the time they wake up to the time they go to bed? I'm going to start playing that role. I'm going to be it until I see it. That's the difference.
I love this, and having I've taken on various different identities through my life. In fact, I've been known as the Queen of Transformation in a number of different areas, from my corporate life to running a business to health and nutrition, becoming a personal trainer to speaking on stage and also my own sort of spiritual journey. And like you say, I think I've sometimes felt like an imposter when I start those new roles, and it's not until I really feel it inside. So, you know, now I can certainly say I might not look like a bodybuilder because I'm not the traditional, you know, burly man. You know, you're much more like the bodybuilder, Dr. James.
Yeah.
But I feel it. I mean, I will argue it to the hilt, and you know I work out like a bodybuilder, and that's definitely my frame of reference, as is my things around money, around financial freedom, about spirituality. But I think it's not until you really feel it deep inside.
Yes.
And that doesn't happen overnight either. And I think what you said before, which was really interesting, it's dealing with those inner wounds,
mm-hmm.
and sort of healing those first before you can.
Yes.
Really.
Yes. Because here's the thing, being, right? If we just think, what does being actually mean? Being is alignment in thinking, feeling, choices, and action. And so when you say you really have to feel it, you do. And that's why being is how to do it. Now, it's much easier to be and have alignment in thinking, feeling, action, and choices when you're doing something, when you're in the gym and when you're eating a particular way and your brain sees, oh, our brains are watching us all the time. So Sonia's brain sees what she's doing and then starts to believe her, right? And then all of a sudden you slowly get in alignment, and it sounds like with you, the last thing that kicks in is the feeling part. Now, here's where the wounds come in. Most people don't realize that we operate from deep-seated unconscious stories. And those stories are what I call seed stories. And the reason I call them seed stories is because just like when you plant a seed in a garden, that seed is going to grow. And if it's a weed, it's going to crowd out everything else. And everything else is going to have to deal with this particular weed. Well, a lot of our seed stories turn into weeds. They influence the way we see ourselves in terms of worthiness, in terms of capability, in terms of belief, in terms of security. And these things make the biggest difference. And so these seed stories sort of are like knots that get tied in our unconscious. When I was a kid, when I was in grade school, young, I used to find these strings of yarn on the floor, and I'd pick them up and I'd tie a knot in it. Then I'd tie a knot on top of that and a knot on top of that and a knot on top of that until I had this big ball of yarn, right? And the seed stories are the original knots. They're so deep down under that ball of yarn that we don't necessarily know that they're there. And I'll give you an example from my own life, and I'll get a little bit vulnerable with you, and just mm-hmm. you guys can forgive me here. But no. So I, years back, about 12 years ago now, I had an affair and went through a divorce with my wife, right? And so on the one hand, it's one of the worst things you can do because it's a self-betrayal. It's also a betrayal of someone you love. And then the woman I was having an affair with was also having another affair. So I was betrayed. And so I was in this betrayal sandwich. Now, this is a wound. Many of you have had it, right? Different things. We've all gone through heartbreak. We've lost loved ones, whatever it is. Now, what ended up happening is I could just push that. A lot of people just go, I'm just going to distract, deny, avoid, you know, blame, complain, whimper, whine, maybe even attack, you know, and the hurt people yeah. type of stuff. But what it did was I said, if I went and looked and tried to look deep into that story, and I used many things here, mainly my writing, journaling, meditation, psychedelics can be beneficial here to help you spot these deep stories. Well, guess what my deep story was? It was a mother wound. I had a very loving mom, but she also was an emotionally volatile mother. She had four kids all by the time she was 24. She was loving, but I never knew what I was going to get. So I turned into a people pleaser. I turned into someone who kept, you know, his emotions in. I also learned to distrust women, right? But yet I wanted female attention. So I had this, you know, and this is what that story, this initial story of that mother wound was all about. And so what that did was that impacted every single romantic relationship I was in, where I would kind of be one foot in, one foot out, not really tell you the truth because I just wanted to please you, looking for attention from other women. And until I actually went and looked at where did these patterns come from? Why is this my identity? Why are these my behaviors? Until I went and looked at that original wound, I did not realize what the behavior was all about. And what you'll do is you'll find this with your eating habits. You'll find this in your romantic patterns. You'll find this in your family dynamics. You'll find this in your relationship with money. You'll find these patterns everywhere. And it is these repeated patterns, stuck emotions, recurrent obstacles that point us to the dysfunctional stories that are keeping us stuck. And we all have them. Like we're all like, you know, I imagine you, Sonny, you might say, well, you know, and a lot of you will say, you know what, Jade, honesty was never an issue for me, but I did have an integrity issue or a boundary issue or whatever it is. We all have our own dysfunctions, and those dysfunctions point us to these deep seed stories that influence our unconscious and then influence our behaviors. And so the hypothesis is that we must go and dismantle these old stories so that we can kill the old identity, so that we can be it until you see it into a new identity. And this is how it works. We need to stop relating to the little Jade kid and the little Jade adolescent and the young 20s Jade and associate with the future self Jade, right? And that's how we begin to make these changes.
Firstly, thank you so much for sharing that. That was lovely. And thank you for sharing that, because that, you know, that vulnerability isn't easy, and I very much respect the work that you're doing on that. I'm quite moved because it actually resonates a lot with me and my journey as well. And one area I don't talk a lot about is my personal relationships, because I guess I've got a lot of wounds around that area and sort of a similar sort of trauma based from, you know, not nothing horrible, but my parents separated when I was very, very young and brought up by my mother, who is fiercely independent. And it's great. I've had great benefits for that because I'm a fiercely independent woman and financially made it on my own and become very successful, but also don't trust men. Because of it, and there's wounds around that. And what I wanted to ask was, you sort of mentioned psychedelics and getting into those wounds. So I've recently been, as I said before, I experiment on myself, and I have experimented around psychedelics as well. Everything from sort of microdosing on psilocybin to larger trips, and I've had some absolutely amazing, what I think are breakthroughs. And I journal about them, and I'm sort of trying to work on this and work out, well, what is this teaching me? What am I seeing in myself? What do you see around that sort of that whole process around the psychedelics and how they can help?
Yeah. Well, if we go back to the analogy of this knotted ball of yarn, right, and this deep story that's underneath, what psychedelics do is they start to unravel that ball of yarn a little bit. And you begin to be able to take a third party perspective. Like if you think about it, right? And especially if we take romance, what we typically do is we look at it through our lens, you know, what we need and what we want and what the other person needs to do for us. And very rarely do people take the other person's perspective. And even more rarely do we take the fly on the wall perspective, and almost never do we take sort of the larger universe or God or source perspective. And so what psychedelics allow you to do, and by the way, they're not the only tool. There's writing techniques like written exposure therapy. There's certain visionary meditation practices that can do this. But what it does is it goes, okay, I'm going to zoom out from Jade or Sonia, and now I'm going to see it from the other person's point of view. And then you're sort of in this dialogue in this very objective way. You know how like if your girlfriend came to you, Sonia, and said, this guy's doing blah, 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 and you know, he's this way or that way, and you're going to go, yeah, but I'm objective and I'm not emotional. I can see your pattern in this, right? Because you're objective. Well, that's what psychedelics allows to do. It pulls out and goes, oh, it wasn't just about the other person. I'm actually seeing a pattern here. And then it can even pull out further and go, not only am I able to relate to, you know, this person and me, I can see how this relates to other people in general or my patterns in general. And then what's really beautiful in some of these trips is it can literally pull out to God perspective or universe perspective, in which case you start to see that some of these things that we put so much heavy weight on are trivial in a sense. And then you start to think about things like this, right? Where you go, oh, you know, I want a woman, perhaps you want a romantic partner that that treats me and makes me feel safe and, you know, these kinds of things. And then I go, oh, but then I have to be that. And so I have to start showing up this way. And psychedelics start allowing you to have this dialogue to see very clearly your patterns. But they do something that's a little bit different than that, because a lot of times therapy can do that, right? Where you're like, oh, I see the pattern. I could talk about it logically. But what they do is the unconscious mind thinks in metaphor and it thinks in emotion. It's like dreams. They don't make a whole lot of sense unless you step back and say, what's the metaphor here? So the unconscious mind is speaking that way. And so with psychedelics, you get dropped into the unconscious and you get put into this metaphor feeling place. That's why it's difficult to describe for people. It's like, I just had this feeling sense of this. And when you have that, that moves you. Now there's one final step to this. And that is now you have to go out into the real world and you have to be it until you see it. And this is where, why a lot of people miss psychedelics, because they get these huge insights. And then they're like, ooh, I want more insights. And so they go back in, but they actually don't ever go, okay, now I've got to be it until you see it. So in my case, I had to essentially go, I want to trust women. I want an honest woman. I want someone who can be emotionally available to me. So then I went, oh, well, that means I have to be honest. That means I have to be trustworthy. That means I have to share my vulnerabilities with my girl. And I also have to allow her to tell me all her scary things and all her dysfunctions. And I need to show up for that, right? And so now I know that I have to be this way. And then I go and practice with my romantic partners out in the real world. And every time I run into a dysfunction, our tendency is, let me run back to my old identity. And when you do that, you reinforce that particular identity. But every time you choose to step into your new identity, you reinforce that. So very early on, I became so honest, I was brutally honest. I swung to the other pendulum and then I had to reel it in, and it took some time to figure it out. Now, a decade later, I can't even imagine who that human was because my identity is now completely different. And so this is how psychedelics can work. They can unravel, allow you to look at things from multiple perspectives and have this real feeling sense of, oh my gosh, it's me in a sense. And I have to adjust my behaviors. And then once you start doing that, the world changes. And it's not easy, right? You know, you're not going to be perfect every time. But when we're speaking of romance, you will know ultimately what I want to feel. I want to feel safe. I want to feel like I can tell you all my dysfunction and you show up for me. And in order for that to happen, I've got to actually step forward and begin to do that. And that's where the magic begins to happen. It's no different in health and fitness. It's no different in finance. And it's no different in purpose and meaning.
Wow. Tell me about your awakening program.
Yeah. And so that I'm glad you asked about that, because that's what this essentially is. The awakening is a program where essentially you come in with me, I guide this, and you are essentially engaged with psychedelics. But more importantly, we are essentially prepping you for this dialogue between selves. So it's not just the other person, it's literally yourself. So in my case, in your case, Sonia, it would be like, we're talking to little Sonia, literally your 6 to 9 year old self. We're getting in dialogue with her to understand her wounds and to understand we can never get rid of her in a sense. She's always going to be there, but we have to learn to parent her in a sense. And the psychedelics will allow you to have a better glimpse into her. And then there's your teenage self. There would be a discussion around, right? Like, what does it mean to essentially feel whether you actually were or not abandoned you know, at such a young age? How did you internalize that? And then it's basically turning it in the awakening and saying, now what are we awakening to? We're awakening to the fact that this pain is actually not really pain. It's promise and possibility. And let me give you an example of this. So you and me and everyone listening, here's what I know about you and you know about me. You have suffered. You know that about me too. We know that about every single person listening to this. And here's how we on the planet. And here's how we deal with suffering. What we do is we have this backpack, and every time we get wounded, a brick gets added into our backpack. And especially these seed story wounds, the original ones, a big cinder block gets thrown into our backpack. And what we do is we carry this backpack around, and it gets heavier and heavier. And we blame, complain, whimper, whine, distract, deny when we're really bad and we really are in our base level self. Sometimes we'll pick a brick out of the backpack and throw it at someone else to try to hurt them. But what happened is we've never actually looked in the backpack to see that those aren't really bricks. What they are is tools, lessons that we can use to help other humans, to grow ourselves, to enrich others, and to better the world. We never get to take this backpack off, but what we can do is we can look in and see that pain and go, oh, that's really interesting. I can use that pain as a path to purpose. I can use my suffering as a source of meaning. I can use my hurt as a way to help. And from my perspective, this is the very point of pain in the first place. The reason that you, Sonia, and you, listener, have your pain, and Jade has his pain. And let's use you for a minute, because you do this amazing show. You pass your lessons on. You're in dialogue with people. You give them permission to show up in the world and be very purposeful in what they do. You do this, and I would guess you do this as your purpose because you've suffered, right? There's part of you that has suffered that goes, I don't want people to suffer in the same way. I've figured certain things out, and I want to share this with other humans.
It's definitely my voids, yes. And again, this, or because I've been running the show for a couple of years, but it's changed. It's changing tilt, and this did come from my trip, in that I really need. I used to hide behind my guests a little bit. I used to interview veterans, and I was much more down the sort of the trauma route, mental health route, talking to people that had led a life less ordinary. And I was sort of hiding behind their stories and fascinated by helping them and their trauma and their mental health. But really deep down, that was because I didn't feel worthy enough to get what I felt that I could bring to the world, which was from my voids and my issues and my wounds, which is now why I'm sort of focusing around the sort of the health, wealth, all of that side of things. Because that's where I think I can bring some benefit, some sort of wisdom to the world.
Yeah. So what's beautiful about that, you are the quintessential next level human, right? Because in a sense, you're taking all the wounds and all the dysfunctions and all the insecurities, which we all have as humans. And you're essentially saying, I've learned lessons from these. Some of them are still struggles. I'm still in process, but I'm going to begin to share these things with other people. Because here's the thing that we know about Sonia, and we know, and I know about every single listener right now. You are unique. You occupy a unique space, place, and time in the universe. You have unique people who've helped and hurt you. You've got your passions, the things you like, your superpowers, your talents. You got a unique perspective and perception. Most importantly, you have your unique pain. And all of that together, right, makes you a unique spiritual fingerprint. In other words, you and I, Sonia, we teach some of the very same things, right? But there's just the way you show up in the way that you do that people want from you. You and I could be teaching the exact same thing, but just the way you say it, right? The way you do it, they resonate with you. Same thing with me. Certain people are going to resonate with me. Other people are not going to resonate with me. They're going to be, I don't like Jade's weird accent. I don't like his bald head. I don't like the way he, you know, and then other people are going to be like, just something about the way Jade explains things, or the way he, his nature. I love hearing it from him. Exactly. And that's really what we're all doing, but we don't get to do that until we decide I am going to show up in this way, in my authentic self, with my wounds, everything on display, because that's what I have to offer the world. Like, it's not fun for me to sit here and talk about my divorce and my affair. That's a horrible thing. But at the same time, I go, you know what? That is my true pain. There is dysfunction around that. I learned a bunch of things around that. And all I need to do is begin to share it. And that's going to help certain people, because certain people have either been betrayed and need to hear it and understand it from the betrayer's side. And other people essentially have betrayed and have never been able to forgive themselves. And I can speak to that. And you can speak to that. And all of you listening can speak to that. You know, we think purpose is this big thing, like you got to do a podcast, you got to write a book and all those things. Purpose is literally just the humble acknowledgement that I bring an experience and an example to the world. And I can, wherever I go, whether it's in a coffee shop, whether it's, you know, with my lover, or whether it's with, you know, my family, or what I'm doing with my money, I can bring a unique experience to the world that no one else can. And I will do that because I can, without the need for acknowledgement, reciprocation, and reward. And when you are operating from that level, all of a sudden, all these struggles around, you know, diet and exercise and the way I look and the way I feel become less important, because you know that you're here for a job. You got a job to do. And that job is important for all the people that you do it for. And yes, some people are not going to love Sonia, and some people aren't going to love Jade. But that's what being in purpose allows you to do. You got to have the courage to be disliked and the courage to show up and be your authentic self. And when you do that, a lot of this other stuff that we struggle with begins to fall away.
I absolutely love this. Oh my gosh. I feel like everything that you're saying is just bouncing off. I'm just feeling complete resonance. I feel like you're there, the vibration levels are there, and I'm completely getting it. So just quickly back to the awakening. In terms of people, if people are nervous, I talked about my own experiences. I've recently been experimenting with psilocybin, which obviously isn't legal here in the UK. Are these certain drugs that you use that are legal, that are illegal? If people are worried about taking them, how can you assure sort of the safety around them?
Yeah. So they are still largely illegal in the United States. And so the ones that I use are MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, and there are others that are legal, like Kana, which is a psychoactive compound.
Please tell me a little bit, and I'm very conscious of the time here.
Yeah.
But I did listen to a podcast of yours literally just very recently on Kana, and I'd never heard of it before. Super interested in it.
Yeah, and it's a lot like, it's not good to do comparisons when we talk about psychoactives and psychedelics, but it is psychoactive, not psychedelic, but it has mechanisms that are somewhat similar to MDMA. It gives you a very euphoric, sort of lightly dissociative, the ability to love yourself and love others who have kind of harmed you, and take, you know, perspective taking. It also has sort of a very grounding sort of element to it. And it allows you an experience that is more gentle. And so you asked what happens if people are afraid. Well, the first thing is that none of the programs that I do make it mandatory that you take these things. In fact, some of the techniques we use, some of the journaling, some of the meditation that I teach individuals, this stuff alone, some of the breathing techniques, this stuff alone can get you that perception shift. And then if you want, you can go anywhere from a micro dose, which is something that makes you a little bit enhanced, to, you know, sort of a what we might call a journey dose, which allows you to essentially drop into altered states of consciousness. And so ultimately, you can go as deep as you want with those. But just being in the room and going through these techniques is going to move people. So the awakening really is, it uses psychedelics, but it's not mandatory to use them. Plus, we spent a lot of time understanding some things. So there are some, some cautions that you want to be aware of. If there is a strong family history of psychosis, this would probably be something that you don't necessarily want to use psychedelics. You might want to use something like Kana or something like that. And by the way, we have no evidence that this actually triggers psychosis in people. It's just out of an abundance of caution. We also see that people who have severe traumas actually tend to do really well with psychedelics, but they can, be in, some of their trips can be difficult. And actually, some of the most powerful journeys are a lot like life. They take you through this emotional journey where one moment you're sad and that one moment you're afraid and the next moment you have an understanding. And that tells you something about life, right? Life gives us these emotions so that we can pay attention, so that we can learn. Psychedelics are a lot like that. They take you through these felt emotional responses so that you can pay attention to particular aspects of yourself so that you can learn. And so most people are afraid because they don't know what's going to happen. And no one usually explains that to them. Oftentimes, too, they're not necessarily under control. So in the awakening event, I usually start people out with smaller doses anyway. They get to decide whether they're going to participate or not. And we give them a very in-depth sort of understanding about what this is going to feel and be like. And to me, that's the most important, part of this.
And when is your next event? Can we put a link? We're going to put a link in the show notes.
It basically, you fly in, you don't necessarily know, we essentially pick you up. We bring you to the location. You're there for 4 days to 7 days, depending on how long. The one in March is going to be 4 days. And essentially you learn about all your stories. We deep dive into seed stories, all of that kind of stuff. Then you have the opportunity for 2 to 3 psychedelic journeys. And so, and the major issue though here is that what I think is different about some of these events is that most people, when they do psychedelics, it's kind of like, okay, see you later. You've had your insights.
Yeah,
what happens next is that we essentially continue to work with you throughout the year, mainly through a new app that I'm developing that essentially continues to find your patterns. Because you have the insight that you've got some dysfunctional patterns, we need to spot those patterns and we need to make a different choice moving forward. Like for me, Jade, it's like every time that I had the opportunity to have a difficult conversation, the old identity would have just people pleased and lied, you know, to make people feel good, versus the new identity, which essentially steps into, I'm going to use this hard conversation. I'm not going to even see it as hard. I'm going to see it as an opportunity for me to connect very deeply with this person. You know, it's funny, in romantic relationships, we oftentimes avoid showing people our dysfunctions until they start showing up later in the relationship. When in reality, like we think intimacy, we tend to think intimacy is, you know, this sexual intimacy, right? With partners is this sort of, which is a beautiful aspect of romance, obviously, but the most beautiful aspect of romance is the integration of, hey, here's my wound. Here's my dysfunction. Here's my shit. I'm going to show it to you. You get to see it. That's the most beautiful, intimate thing about that. Now imagine we're doing that with ourselves as well, where we go, hey, Jade, you know, little Jade, teenage Jade, you know, wounded Jade, here's my dysfunction. Are you going to meet with me and parent me? Same thing that we would want from a romantic partner, right? In a sense, a romantic partner is our parent, our best friend, our lover, our comic relief, you know, our entertainment. They fulfill a lot of roles. Part of the reason, by the way, that we attach so strongly in romance is that we outsource our need for acceptance and belonging, when really what we need to do is be in dialogue with our past selves' identity, clear that, and then walk forward into a new identity. So the awakening is unpacking all this kind of thought process and awakening into our new identity rather than continuing to live into our old identity. And there's a very specific process that can be done, but it's not just taking psychedelics. It's taking psychedelics and this integration technique that happens in the real world.
Wow. No, and relationships, you know, it's that area that triggers you and it brings out all of these wounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been single for a couple of years, and I always say, oh, I'm happy and single. And there's a reason behind that, because nothing, you don't get triggered when you're single. It's very difficult to be triggered when you're single. But as soon as a relationship comes along, or as soon as I feel like I'm going to get vulnerable or someone could hurt me, then bang, triggers, walls come up, and I can feel it. And suddenly I'm like, I'm better off single because I don't have all these emotions. But it's actually facing that, not running away, not building the wall, and working into the wound, I think is so important. And like you say, Jade, it's that's where the learning, and that's where you can really change your identity. I love all this.
Yeah. Wow, and one final thing I'll say about this in terms of romance is that that time alone that you have, that time is an incredibly important time to know yourself, but then you need to have the practice. And the practice is, right? It's like, okay, I got to get in relationship. And then you have to go in my, you know, I'm speaking to myself and you and all the listeners here as well. Then you have to go, okay, now that I have this new person, I have to understand that I have to practice. And the way I practice is sharing all my shit. Because what do you really want? You want a romantic partner who goes, you're only human. I love you for your dysfunction. Yeah, you're a little strange or weird or whatever it is, but so am I. And I'm going to help you grow. And I'm going to help make you feel safe. And I'm going to understand your wounds because you shared them with me. Now, how, if they don't understand and we never volunteer them, how can they step into being a better partner? And more importantly, if when we're alone, if we're not in dialogue with those other parts of ourselves, we won't be able to even have that conversation with the romantic partner. And we're talking romance just because we all know that's the most important relationship, most substantial relationship most of us adults have. But this goes to friends, this goes to family, this goes to all other relationships as well. And it goes to our relationship with food. It goes to our relationship with exercise. It goes to our relationships and dysfunctions with money. It's all the same stuff and the process is the same.
Yeah. And funnily enough, yes, it can be the hardest relationship of them all. Jade, I have absolutely love this. I'm going to come to my final question, though, although I'd love to have you on as a guest again.
Yeah, it's been fun.
What do you want people to remember you for? Mm.
Yeah, well, this speaks right to what we were talking about. I want people to remember me as the most honest person that they've met and the most generous person they met. I want people to see me as a person who was about meaning over money and memories over money and someone who was generous with my time, right? No one's going to care when I die about my six-pack abs and my bank account. What they're going to care about, right, is how I showed up, how I made time, the experience and the example that I set. And what isn't it interesting that the very thing I struggled with is the very thing that I'm an expert in now, that is the very thing that I want to be known as, that is the very thing that I give to the world as a gift. And so that's the thing that I think happens with most people. That's the job that we're here to do, you know? And so to me, who would I be without my pain and my dysfunction and my mess ups? Perhaps much less than I am. And therefore I will embrace it and own it. And I hope that people will see me for that. It's the reason that I'm even here talking to you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jade, for being you and for showing up, being vulnerable and showing us your pain. Where can people find out about you?
Yeah. So you can find me on social media. We're all there, it seems like, nowadays. So at Jade Tita on social media. My podcast is Next Level Human podcast. And then JadeTita.com. And Sonia, thank you for your work. Thank you for being so sweet and having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning into the show. Please subscribe and share. That would really help me get these valuable messages out.